Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. I want to thank you for coming to the Tattered Cover to support your independent bookstore so that we can have the honor of having Gregory Maguire, my hero. Like so many of us, I've loved The Wizard of Oz for many years. But as a grown-up social worker, I thought Dorothy was a bit ditzy to bother with, so I put it aside. Then in 1995, I found Wicked and was enthralled. Each book in the series has maps, which was wonderful. I felt like a kid again, and sort of, and complex characters that struggle with good and evil in themselves and in the Land of Oz. When Gregory was young, he could only see one movie a year on the television. And so his parents one year picked The Wizard of Oz, and then they left the room. He was enthralled with the sordid and musical, et cetera, factors of it, and it stayed with him for a good long time, as we can see. He wants us to remember the humanity of our enemies, and he has one time hypothesized that there could be another verse to Over the Rainbow. The dreams that you're scared to dream really do come true. So let's welcome him and hear about this wonderful book.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you all for coming here, not just to see me, but to be however many pillars and posts you are of the great magical land of the independent bookstore. So I really appreciate that, and I know you do too, or you wouldn't be here. My publisher does ask me to tell people. This always makes me feel a little embarrassed because I'm sort of socially awkward, if not confused, and as well as shy. But they make me do this. So I'm supposed to tell you that you are invited to face me or touch me or something on Facebook, you know? What is it? No, I'm not kidding. I really, what's the word? This, like me? Friend me. You know, goose me. I don't care. But you're invited to do it. They like to see that that the numbers are going up. I mean, I don't know why. It's not as if pennies come in as the number, as the counter ticks over. But you're invited to do that. And toward that end, I try to take away from the publisher the use of a Facebook, you know, connection from being, you know, merchandising. And I try to actually post, you know, poetry, not mine because you wouldn't want it. You know, if something happens in the world and it strikes something, you know, a brief thought, it's, you know, I suppose it's a kind of a Twitter, but anyway, feel free to do that. And I'm going to be posting photographs from the events. This is my seventh night on the road, and I have about 12 nights left. And as far as I know, I still have children at home, but I'm not really sure. I'm going to read from two sections of Out of Oz. I'm going to read part of the prologue and then about a page and a half from a middle section. And I know it's a new book, and so I will be giving a little bit away, but I don't think anything away that you can't live without knowing. This is from the prologue. It would take Dorothy Gale and her relatives 3 days to reach the mountains by train from Kansas, the conductor told them. No matter what the schoolteacher had said about Galileo, Copernicus, and those other spoil sports, any cockamamie theory that the world was round remained refuted by the geometrical instrument of a rattling train applied to the spare facts of a prairie. Dorothy watched eagles and hawks careering too high to cast shadows. She watched the returning larks and bluebirds, and she wondered what they knew about the shape of the world and if they would ever tell her. Then the Rockies began to ice up along the spring horizon beyond the shoot-em-up town of Denver. Uncle Henry had never seen such a sight. He declared himself bewilligered at their height. "They surely do remind me of the great Kells of Oz," agreed Dorothy, "though the Kells looked less bossy somehow." She tried to ignore the glance Uncle Henry shared with Aunt Em. Some of the passes being snowed over, even in early April, the train made slower progress than the timetable had promised. Auntie Em fretted that their hotel room would be given away. Uncle Henry replied with an attempt at savoir faire. "I'll wire ahead at the next opportunity, Em. Hush yourself and enjoy the nation." What a charade that they were accustomed to taking fancified holidays. They had little extra money for emergencies. Dorothy knew that. They were spending their savings on her behalf. The train chuffed along valleys noisy with rushing waters, inched along trestles as if testing them for purchase. It lollygagged up slopes. One cloudy afternoon, it maneuvered through so many switchbacks that the travelers lost all notion of east and west. In her seat, Dorothy hummed a little. Once she thought she saw a castle on a ridge, but it was only a tricky rock formation. "But I never before saw a rock that looked like a castle," said Auntie Em brightly. "You never saw a castle," thought Dorothy, and tried not to be disappointed. They worried their way through Nevada and its brownish springtime, and at last came down into California, through a napland of orchards and vineyards. When the train paused outside Sacramento to take on tinder, Dorothy saw a white peacock strutting along next to the tracks like a general surveying his troops. It paused at her window and fanned out its impossible stitchery. She could have sworn it was a white peacock and that it would speak, but Toto began to yap out the open window and the bird kept its own counsel. Finally, the train shrugged and chuffed into San Francisco, a city so big and filthy and confounding that Uncle Henry dared to murmur, "This beats your old Emerald City, I'd warrant." "Henry," said his wife, "pursed lips are kind lips." They found their hotel. The clerk was nice enough, a clean young man whose lips weren't so much pursed as rubied. He forgave their delay, but could no longer supply them with a room, only one flight up, as they'd been promised. Aunt Em refused to try Mr. Otis's hydraulic elevator, so they had to climb up five flights. They carried their own bags to avoid having to tip. That night, they ate Kaiser rolls they'd bought at the train station. All the next day, they stayed in the hotel's penitentially severe room. As Aunt Em recovered from the taxation to her nerves by the swaying of railway cars, she could not tolerate being left alone in a hotel chamber on their first day, not when it felt as if the whole building was rocking and bucking as the train had done. Dorothy was eager to go and see what she could see, but they wouldn't let her walk out alone. "A city is not a prairie," Aunt Em proclaimed through the damp washcloth laid from forehead to chin. "No place for a compromised girl without a scrap of city wits." The spring air wafting through the open window next morning revived Auntie Em. All these flights up, it smelled of lilacs and hair oil and horse manure and hot sourdough loaves. Encouraged, the Flatlanders ventured outdoors. Dorothy carried Toto in a wicker basket for old time's sake. They strolled up to the carriage entrance of the famous Palace Hotel and pretended they were waiting for a friend so they could catch a glimpse of sinful excess. What an accomplished, offhand manner they showed, sneaking sideways glances through the open doors at the potted ferns, the swags of rust-red velvet drapery, the polished doorknobs. Also, the glinting necklaces and earrings and cufflinks and gentlemen's shirts starched so clean it hurt the eyes to look. "Smart enough," said Auntie Em, "for such like who feel the need to preen in public." She was agog and dismissive at once, thought Dorothy, a considerable achievement for a plain-minded woman. "The Palace Hotel is all very well," said Dorothy at lunch, a frankfurter and a sumptuous orange from a stall near Union Square. "But the palace of the Emperor in the Emerald City, I shall be ill." Auntie Em, going pale. "I shall be ill, Dorothy, if after all we have mortgaged on this expedition, you insist on seeing San Francisco by comparing it to some imagined other world. I shall be quite, quite ill. I mean nothing by it," said Dorothy. "Please, please, I'll be still. It's true, I've never seen anything like most of this."
"The world is wonderful enough without your having to invent an alternative," said Uncle Henry.
A tired man by now, not a well man either, and stretched to put things baldly while there was still time.
"Who is going to take you in marriage, Dorothy, if you've already given yourselves over to delusions and visions?"
"Snares of the wicked one!" Auntie Em, spitting an orange seed into the street.
"We have been kind, Dorothy, and we have been patient. We have sat silent, and we have spoken out. You must put the corrupting nightmare of Oz behind you. Close it behind a door and never speak of it again. You will find yourself locked within it, alone. We aren't going to live forever, and you must learn to manage in the real world."
"I should imagine I'm too young to be thinking of marriage."
"You're already 16, snapped her aunt. "I was married at 17. Uncle Henry's eyes glinted merrily, and he mouthed across his wife's head at Dorothy, "Too young."
Dorothy knew they had her best interests at heart, and it was true that since her delivery from Oz 6 years ago, she had proved a rare creature, a freak of nature. Her uncle and aunt didn't know what to make of her. When she had appeared on the horizon, crossing the prairie by foot, shoeless but clutching Toto, long enough after Uncle Henry and Aunt Em's home had been carried away that they'd built themselves a replacement, her return was reckoned a statistical impossibility. Who rides the winds in a twister and lives to tell about it? Though Kansans set store on the notion of revelation, they are skeptical when asked to accept any whole cloth gospel not measurable by brass tacks they've hammered into the dry goods counter themselves. So, upon her return, Dorothy had been greeted not as a ghost or an angel, neither blessed by the Lord nor saved by a secret pact she must have made with the evil one, just tetched, concluded the good folks in the district. Tetched in the big fat head. The local school children, who had often before given Dorothy a wide berth, now made irrevocable their policy of shunning her. They were unanimous, but wordless about it. They were, after all, Christians. She'd learned to keep Oz to herself, more or less. Of course, things slipped out. But she didn't want to be figured as peculiar. She'd taken up singing on the way home from the schoolhouse as a way to disguise the fact that no one would walk with her. And now that she was done with school, it seemed that there were no neighbors who might tolerate her company long enough to find her marriageable. So Uncle Henry and Aunt Em were making this last-ditch effort to prove that the workaday world of the Lord God Almighty was plenty rich and wonderful enough to satisfy Dorothy's curiosity for marvels. She didn't need to keep inventing impossible nonsense. "She keeps on yammering about that fever dream of Oz, and she'll be an old spinster with no one to wobble to but the bones of Toto." I'm going to jump over a little bit. They go to see the ocean. Kansans don't believe in the ocean unless they get to see it for themselves with their own eyes, as who could. But the day they get there, the Pacific edge of San Francisco has not yet been developed at the early part of the 20th century. And as it happens, one of those many you know, fogs that come in like on little cat feet have come in, and they can hear it, but they can't see it. Auntie M catches a sniffle, and she wants to go back to the hotel, and she does, and she takes to her bed. So they've kind of got a clue of it, but they haven't seen it yet. And Auntie M allows Uncle Henry and Dorothy to go out to a Chinese restaurant at night for dinner. Just before Dorothy leaves, the woman, who is suspiciously like a munchkin, she's really small, and she's dressed in Chinese red silks, gives Dorothy a little cricket in a box and says, "For ruck, cricket for ruck." "Why do I need luck?" Dorothy thought she'd spoken to herself, but the woman answered as if she'd spoken aloud. Maybe Dorothy had. Maybe she was Dottie, a dodo, like those children had called her. Dottie Dorothy, Dorothy Dodo. "You on journey going," said the old woman. Though whether this was an observation, a prophecy, or a swift goodbye, Dorothy couldn't tell. Distastefully, Dorothy fingered the little cage. The locusts of Kansas had made her dubious about crickets. Still, the little twiglet was alive, for it bounced against its straw-colored bars. It didn't sing. "I don't believe people should be in cages," she said to Uncle Henry. "People neither," he answered almost by rote, his one-note message. "Don't cage yourself and your fantasticals, girl. Before it's too late, get your mind out of Oz, or you'll be sorry." "I take your point, Uncle Henry. I've taken it for some time now." "You're welcome." He put his hand on his rib and breathed through the pain for a moment. They go back to the hotel at night. Electrification has just come to San Francisco. At the hotel, she begged Uncle Henry that they ride the lift up to their floor. "Your Auntie M wouldn't approve, fretting for our safety," he replied. "Whether she's around to notice or not, I never behave as she disagree with in honor of her." What a set of stairs to walk up, thought Dorothy. But when they reached the fifth floor, he winked at her and kept going. 3, 4 more flights. She followed wordlessly. At the top level, they found a door. It opened easily enough to reveal to them a glowing cityscape. The canyons between the buildings were running with light and sound on the electric blue darkness all around. All around Dorothy and Uncle Henry hung the illuminated windows of people in rooms, a museum of their living lives. Golden squares and rectangles. "Oh," she exclaimed, "no fibbing. It's better than the Emerald City. But where's the ocean? Which way? We're so high. Can we see it?" They worked out which direction it must be. This late at night, there was nothing that way but darkness.
"That empty place without lights," said Uncle Henry. "It must be there, though you can't see it."
"Some say that about other places," she replied, but not harshly. "Beyond the ocean, what's that?"
"The land of the Japanese and the Chinese. A whole society of them, all talking in that singy-song way they got."
"And the ocean," she could hardly bear it. "What's it like?"
"I ain't never seen it yet, but tomorrow we can come back up here."
She was lost that night when she finally managed to sleep in the raspy claws of dreams. As the first light weakened the blackness of sky, Toto began to whine. "Hush! Auntie M is feeling poorly after our long trip." But Toto needed to go outside. Dorothy hunched herself into her clothes and grabbed the cricket cage and let herself out of the room, leaving the door open a crack. It didn't take long to find Toto a scrap of junk ground in which to do his business. Dorothy turned her head politely. Many of the lights were lowered now, but there was a strange apprehensiveness to the street, like the setting of a stage in which a play was about to begin. The charcoal of the night decayed into a smokier shade, still dark, but somehow more transparent. "Come on, we'll be in 6 kinds of trouble if they find us out here in the street alone," said Dorothy. "Let's go up." In the lobby, she saw the elevator man asleep in a lounge chair, his head to one side and his little cap askew. In that funny high-waisted jacket, he looked like a flying monkey she had once known. How were they ever affording this poor dear Henry and M? So frightened of her, so eager for an acceptable future.
She stepped into the cage and pulled the door shut. The door was fretted, like sets of linked scissors, like the threads of an old apron if you scrub it too hard with lye. There was a single control, as far as she could see. She gripped the brass handle and revolved it a full half turn, and the floor began to lift with Dorothy and Toto and the cricket inside. She almost squealed, but she knew the mirror sound might wake the elevator attendant, and she probably risked being put in jail for ambushing a lift and taking it on a joyride. The perforated room sailed up past the fifth floor all the way to the ninth, which led to the roof. She remembered. She tiptoed from the elevator cabin and shouldered her way through the door into the chill of dawn above the ocean. She could just make out a tongue of sea beyond the buildings to the west. No sound from this far away, no apparent motion, only a lapidary expanse dimming and shading into the sky. No horizon line, just endlessness. Toto began to whimper and to jump around as if he wanted to leap from the ninth floor. "It's not frightening, it isn't," she said, though she didn't know whether she was trying to convince herself or the dog. "It's just the ocean and another world on the other side. You know all about that. You're the best traveled mutt in history, Toto. Stop your fussing. What are you fussing about?" The dog appeared to be going mad, running in circles around her and yipping in some sort of distress. Dorothy set the cricket cage upon the stone barrier that kept people from tumbling into the street. "You can come out," she said to the cricket. "I make my own luck. You make yours. Nobody should live in a cage. Never surrender to that." The cricket emerged and rubbed some scratchy parts of itself together. Whether it leaped or whether the wind took it, Dorothy couldn't say. The cricket guest was there one moment and gone the next. "Safe landing," she cried after it. "Oh, all right, Toto, stop that infernal fussing. The wind isn't going to take you, too. Once in your life was enough." She picked up the dog and went back into the building. The elevator was where she had left it, quivering at this height. She would ride it down to the fifth floor and go in and rest next to her uncle and aunt. She had spied something of the ocean, some little hem of it. The globe was round. She could see there was another world beyond this one. That would have to do. Meanwhile, some corn-blind farmer, walled on four sides of his life by superior alfalfa, was waiting for her. She began her descent. She passed the eighth floor and the seventh. At 5:15 on the morning of April 18th, 1906, the buildings of San Francisco started to shake. So, the story is called Out of Oz because it begins out of Oz. All the other three books in the Wicked series began in Oz, but this story begins more like the original Wizard of Oz, or like Alice in Wonderland, or Peter Pan, or Narnia. You go through a casement window, or a rabbit hole, or a wardrobe, or the cover of a book, and you find yourself in another world. I just want to read about a page and a half more. When Dorothy gets back to Oz, things have changed. A lot of history has happened, as has been noted in those other two very long and boring books. And Dorothy has to be caught up on things. She discovers several things have happened. Glinda is under house arrest. The political climate has changed. Political climates, you may have noticed, have a habit of doing that. They kind of like to. The political climate has changed, and the dread Wicked Witch of the East and the Witch of the West, now that they're safely off stage, can be rehabilitated in memory as political martyrs. And so when Dorothy shows up, it's very expedient for the powers that be to put her on trial for the death of Elphaba and Nessarose. Munchkinland has long since separated from Loyal Oz. That happened in Wicked. But Loyal Oz has invaded Munchkinland to try to take it back. So a little bit like Kuwait in Iraq. But Dorothy, here, I just want to read a page and a half from the trial of Dorothy. "The cowardly lion, whom I call Burr, B-R-R-R,
comes to Munchkinland to see whether he can speak in Dorothy's behalf in case there's a need to. Here she is coming into the courtroom for the first time. And this is just a short bit. Dorothy's head rose farther out of the square in the flooring. She was facing the magistrate, who glared upon her as if he hadn't seen her before. Maybe she'd been kept sequestered from everyone involved in this trial. Six times, Temper Bailey rotated his head on his stem. The counsel assigned her is an owl. And this point of view is from the Cowardly Lions. This is like climbing into the hayloft back in Kansas. Yes, it was Dorothy's voice, her real voice, misguidedly cheerful as always. Burr felt the muffin lurch in his throat. Still, you'd never see a Kansan owl dressed up in a petticoat. Something stronger than a titter rippled through the hall. Temper Bailey blinked balefully. Mind your manners, said Lord Nip. That's your representation. What a hoot, Dorothy replied, meaning no disrespect, of course. She turned to look at the crowd seated on the floor and in the galleries. Burr knew himself to be in the shadows, as he had crouched down by the wainscoting below where strong sunlight was heaving in through the windows. He doubted that Dorothy could see him, at least not at first, and that gave him a chance to study her. Either she'd become stunted by her experience in Oz a generation ago, or some perverse magic was at work. Yes, she was quite recognizably Dorothy, those cocoa-bright eyes, the way she led with her shoulders and clavicle. Surely she ought to be middle-aged by now, but she seemed merely a few years older than he remembered her. Taller, but hardly leaner. Her face remained eager and unshuttered, even after these latest travails. Proof of Dorothy. Lord Nip banged a gavel, as if to remind himself he was in charge. Identify yourself. Name, age, origin, and your designs upon us. Well, that's easy enough, said Dorothy. As if she couldn't decide who to love first, she turned this way and that. Toward Temper Bailey, who inched away on his perch. Then toward Lord Nip. And finally, to Dame Fegg. That's the opposition lawyer, barrister. I'm Dorothy Gale, if you please, from the state of Kansas, the 34th state in the Union, a free state now and proud of it. No slavery to speak of. She made a clumsy curtsy to a family of pigs in the second row, one of the few groups of animals present. We're still working out a few wrinkles.
Answer the question, said Nip.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm 16 at my last birthday, you know. Nip scribbled a few marks upon a pad and frowned.
And your intention in returning to Oz after your long absence?
Goodness, there was no intention involved. After what I'd been through, do you think I'd choose to return? I'd have to be mad. Well, scratch that. The truth is, I seem to have no control over my whereabouts. Makes me dangerous to let out on the street, says Uncle Henry. Or said Uncle Henry. She teared up a little. I don't know if he's still alive. What are you cawing about? Asked Dame Fegg. You haven't answered the first question posed by the magistrate. I have no designs in Oz, said the girl. Uncle Henry and Auntie Em and I had gone to San Francisco, see, for various family reasons. My mental fitness for marriage among them, to be blunt. We ate funny food and saw sights till we felt like gagging. And then, one morning, oh my word, I took a trip to the roof of my hotel, and the whole building began to shake and buckle, and I could hear stones falling and people screaming. For a moment, the elevator stopped, and everything became dark, and I could detect a bad smell, though maybe that was Toto, my dog. Then the elevator began to move again, sliding faster and faster, and I thought I would smash to my death at the bottom of the chute. It was much the scariest thing that ever happened to me since the twister. The noise grew louder, the air grew thick with powder. A moment later, while in the elevator, I lost my mind 'cause my dog had got away. Burr had to concede it. She was dotty as ever. But blistering buckets. How people listened to her. They were nearly swaying in time with her rhetoric.
the earth began to shake. For goodness sake, I knew I made a big mistake when the cage began to shake.
A little less of the theatrics, said the magistrate.
When I came to, she continued less sonorously, I found myself in the elevator cage, half buried in a landslide. When people dug me out, I assumed they would be San Franciscans. But just my luck. Imagine a tribe of little people. Again. At first, I thought I'd discovered yet another tiresome country. But eventually, somebody called Sakali Ofish told me I was in Oz. So you see, Your Honor, I had no designs at all, except to have a nice holiday and maybe buy some lace for my hope chest. And the off chance any fellow ever gets interested in me. She looked with big eyes at the Munchkins. I don't think that my prospects for a husband are terribly strong. Not at this particular point in time. And that's where I'll stop. Now, I know that we want to stop just, you know, pretty precisely at 8:15, so there's enough time to get books signed before the store closes at 9, as I understand it. So we have about 15 minutes of for questions, and I'm happy to talk about this book, the other book, writing, the musical theater, you know, whatever it is that engages you. And so don't be shy, so you can see I'm easy to ask questions of. Yes. The question from the theology student in the room, and there may be more than one, is why in my novel, The Next Queen of Heaven, did I choose to make the two warring faiths, as it were, Pentecostalism and Catholicism? There are two reasons, partly because the story is set in upstate New York, where I am from, and I know, you know, from dirty personal experience that there is... I wouldn't say no love to be lost. Maybe there's blood to be shed between certain Catholic groups and certain fundamentalist groups, especially. The smaller town you get, the more intense it seems to be. I was raised Catholic and am still a Catholic, if you can believe that. I live in a fantasy world, but... And I have relatives. I have dear relatives who are fundamentalists. So my attempt was not to elevate one faith above the other, but really to talk in some ways about what they had in common and what they give to people, especially what they give to people who are, you know, not part of the 1%. Not to mix metaphors, but you know what I mean. Oh, sorry. Bad neck. Yes, please. The question is, did I ever intend for Wicked to become a musical? And I, not when I wrote it. I thought it had a fairly good shot of becoming a movie as I was writing it, given the popularity of the subject. But you will note, if you've read Wicked, that Elphaba can sing. Elphaba could sing before Broadway got a hold of her. She sings for her father when her father's doing ministerial work. Missionary work down in Quadling Country. She sings in a pub after one of the Amas has died. She stands up, and the paragraph in which I describe her singing in the pub is meant to inspire in readers the realization that Elphaba is singing somewhere over the rainbow from her point of view, and that from her point of view, any place else would be better than Oz. So I did that on purpose, because as I began to reflect on why it was that Margaret Hamilton scared me so much as a kid, it was partly that she didn't have her own musical number. Almost everybody else did. I mean, the wizard didn't either. But, you know, if I only had a heart, if I only had the brain, if I only had the nerve, you know, what would she have said? If I only had a microphone, if I only had an accompanist, you know, if I only had, you know, a stiff scotch? I don't know. But the thing is... sorry?
It's not easy being green.
It is not easy being green. And she might... You know, if she had been given a chance to speak of why she was the way she was, even one sentence, we would not have been able to hate her as much as we did as children. So it was important to me to make sure that she could sing, but nobody... You know, it wasn't going to be remembered about her. that she could sing because she was going to be tarnished as the witch. And everybody knows witches don't sing. So, in a way, I set up the paradigm. I set up the paradigm for the play to become a musical. I just didn't see it coming. And was I happy about it? Yes. Am I still happy about it? Yes. Are my bankers happy about it? Very. Yes, please. The musical is different from the book. There are, if you haven't seen the musical, or if you haven't read the book yet, I will just, I won't do a spoiler, but I will say there are some eensy-weensy little changes at the end. You know, you hardly notice them. They just fly by. When I first heard what I call an oratorio reading of the musical, which was done with a cast of 18, and Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel, and a pianist and a narrator, and people would just, they just had scripts and scores, and they would stand and sing when it was their time and sit down. When I first heard that, and I got to the last, say, 2.5 minutes of the play, and I saw the changes that were going to be wrought upon the original, I have to admit, I did, you know, gouge half of the forearm off of the friend who was sitting next to me. But it only took me about 5 times seeing it in the theater before I realized why if that had been done that way. I think the novel is intended to be like Dickens or Tolstoy. I mean, I intentionally wrote a novel that was to feel as if it had come out of the 19th century. You know, it's thick, it's long, it's boring. That was what I wanted. I wanted readers to have to work for what was in that book. And consequently, I never expected it to be a success. I just expected that there'd be some readers who liked doing that kind of work for their fiction. But the fact is that the play takes a lot of the same ambitions as the novel, but makes them smaller so that they can be understood in a shorter amount of time. It takes 2.5 hours to watch a play. It takes about 38 hours to read a novel as long as Wicked. And at the end of the play, Glinda and Elphaba are separated forever. Glinda thinks Elphaba is dead, and Elphaba knows she can never come back. In the terms of what gives joy to life, that is, that's a death. It's just a death guised as something else. And when you come out of the theater, if you're at all moved by the play, you are left with the same feeling that I intended you to be left with at the end of the novel, which is what all art tells us, that life is short, that friends and lovers matter, and that what we do is vital. We have to choose what we do. We have to stand behind what we've chosen. I think you get the same message from the play as from the book, and that's all I cared about. Was the message. Yes, please. And then over here.
Well, first I just want to say thank you. Because I, avid reader, I was a literature major, my first degree, and I've read all great literature that I can get my hands on. And I've never had a character that I can identify with in literature or in real life like I have with Elphaba.
Well, thank you. That's a real accolade. And luckily I mic'd, so I'm going to be able to keep that and play it back to myself. I really appreciate that. Yes.
And very fascinating, interesting little side story. I have a 19-year-old daughter who read this before I did when she was real little. And before she even read it, she used to refer to me as Spiky. And when she met, and then it was funny because when I read Son of a Witch, we had never read Son of a Witch, she called me that first. So that was always fascinating. So I, again, felt closer to her. Of course, I cry hysterically when I read it every year, and the musical, which I've seen 12, 15 times. But my question is, it's kind of a follow-up to the vein we're on, is that musical's wonderful, different story. They now want to make a movie of the musical. Why not let them tell the story of... Because I know with modern culture, people are more attuned to wanting to watch instead of read, which I personally don't like, but that's a story that needs to be told as well. Why choose the musical, which is just taking it out of its venue, which again is not good.
Right. It makes the musical makes it a little more chocolatey. But here's what I'll tell you about this, and maybe this will make you feel better. There will be eventually a movie of Wicked the Musical. It will be called Wicked the Musical. And it will be based on Wicked the Musical. They actually no longer have the legal rights to go back and take anything that they haven't already taken.
But there's also, I'm told, an ABC miniseries in the offing. Selma Hayek is heading it up, and that is going to be based on Wicked the novel. So my hope is that some of the darkness, some of the more rotten parts, and also some of the more glorious parts, and the political parts, will be able to be recaptured in Wicked, the miniseries. And what they do with Wicked the Lunchbox, I do not know. Let's see. Over here, I'm watching the clock, so I want to...
I just had a question regarding the Clock the Time Dragon.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it shows up very mysteriously in a bunch of books, and I'm hoping it's in this one as well, but I have no idea.
The question is, what was I smoking when... what was I thinking when I came up with the Clock of the Time Dragon? I was cleaning up some old files not long ago, and I came across a postcard that somebody had sent me about 25 years ago, or 30. And it was sort of 1940s era, a picture of a famous clock in Germany. I don't remember the name of it. And it was there was a metal grommet in the middle, and there was a die-cut window, much like the die-cut holes in the cover of Wicked, and a wheel at the edge, like in a pop-up book, so you could turn the wheel, and the figures in the die-cut hole would change, and they were all figures of saints and martyrs and things. On the back of the postcard, the person who had sent it to me wrote a quote from Ecclesiastes. Our theology student can tell us more about Ecclesiastes. But the quote was something like, it wasn't the famous one, "To everything there is a time," but it was more everything in its time, and went on something a little bit. But the combination of the quote, which is about things having their own time, and the clock, which was mechanical, I could make it happen with my hands. When I found this, I said to myself, that's where the Clock of the Time Dragon came from. It's some combination of the idea of fate and the idea of manipulation. Godly fate and earthly manipulation. That's what, you know, working together. It's contradictory. It's confusing. I can't say, you know, I'm not writing allegory, so it doesn't stand for anything. It simply is itself. And I hope it never pulls up into my driveway, believe me. Let's see. Do we have one more very quick question? Anybody burning to ask a last question? Yes, sir. Well, I'm in therapy for this. the comment is about the tone of the 19th century aspects of the novel and of my writing, which is intentionally old-fashioned. I mean, I do that because it's just another tool I use to make the place feel foreign and yet recognizable. I use as many tricks as I have, making up words that you think you almost heard before, etc. Yet when I read it with vigor, and I would propose that probably an author can read his or her work with vigor more easily than a reader, especially first time out, because you don't really know what the intention of every sentence is until you've read it. But I would also propose that for those who read the books more than once, that when you go back a second time, you read with vigor in a different way. And thirdly, and this I think is something I'll leave you with, thirdly I'll say, when nobody else is around, go in the bathroom and read a couple of paragraphs aloud and let yourself go. Yeah, really, really, let yourself go. It can be quite cathartic to approach a piece of literature, either that you understand or that you don't understand. And I read aloud while I'm writing all the time to get the cadences and to drop myself into the pool of the story. So I'm sorry that we don't have more time for questions. You know, to have flown all the way across the country for that short a time is sad. But I am not sad. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy you came out, and I will be happy to sign your books. So, oh, one last thing. The first edition, the first printing which you have in your hands, has a full-color end paper. Open it up and take a look at it if you have it. Full-color map. The second printing will be black and white. It will be back to Kansas after the second printing.
Oh, wow.
So this is, in a sense, a collector's item. So I figure it's not fair if I don't tell you that. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.